Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Increasingly, high-tech exercise equipment is moving from the gym into households. The latest example is the mirror. It's a full-length reflective screen in which you watch yourself exercise while streaming a fitness class. Yesenia Funes is a reporter for Gizmodo's new subsite, Earther. She recently wrote about Mirror. We'll post a link to it on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Yesenia Funes joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me in.
More and more home gym equipment is getting smarter and smarter, such as Peloton. Is this just the latest in a trend of smart home fitness projects?
I mean, it's definitely looking like it. I'm certainly not the most savvy when it comes to the smart home fitness trend, but I do like to work out. And the mirror was one of the most interesting experiences I've had so far working out, especially at home.
Tell us about Mirror and what it is, how it works, what it does.
Yeah, so it's essentially, think of a full-length mirror. That is essentially what it looks like. You could use it as a full-length mirror in your home. You prop it up either against the wall, you can hang it on the wall, and you operate the device with your phone. There's no buttons on the mirror itself. Everything is through the phone app. And you launch a class. You can take a live class if you happen to, get on at the right time, or you can take a class that was previously recorded. You sit yourself with some kind of Bluetooth heart monitor, which allows the device to give you feedback and kind of keep track of how you've been doing. And you get to it. It offers a bunch of different classes from boxing, yoga, bar, just kind of like full body workouts. It's pretty straightforward, I guess, if you're used to doing video home workouts, except that you can see yourself while also seeing the instructor, which is
How does that work, that you can see yourself and also see what's going on in the class?
Yeah, so you can change the size of the instructor on the class to what suits you. And because it operates in mirror, you can see your whole body in the way you would with a full-length body mirror. And the instructor, I guess it depends on how you position yourself. They can kind of sit to the side. But it fits quite perfectly. You can see yourself and almost right next to you on the mirror, you see the instructor and how they're moving.
How does the streaming portion of it work? Is it all live classes?
So it's not all live. They have live classes that you can log on to if you catch it at the right time. But they also just have a catalog of classes that you can stream at any moment. I did experience that with some of the live classes. However, if your Wi-Fi speed wasn't up to par, there was a bit of lag. I experienced that my Wi-Fi is not always the best, and I experienced some lag time when I attempted to join one of the live classes. That was kind of what was most interesting to me, was the ability to have a live class at home. However, I didn't have the best experience, so that's why I ended up preferring the classes that you could just choose from, because it also, you could just pick it on your own time. You didn't have to worry about making a class at, 6 a.m. or at 7 p.m. It was just whenever you were available, which is really helpful.
And then you don't have to worry about lags either, right?
Exactly. Yeah, those don't lag.
You worked out and lived with Mirror for a few weeks. You did like it. How much space does it take up?
It's pretty small. It's a 40-inch display, and I mean, literally, it takes up as much space as a body mirror would take up in your home. You could, lay it against the door if that's your go-to, but ideally, it's on a wall. It just kind of blends in. We had it in our living room, and we had guests over, and they would just kind of assume that it was a regular mirror. It wasn't a distracting addition to the home at all. It was actually kind of nice, because you could just check yourself out while you're walking out the house. The way you would with a regular mirror.
How do they pick the instructors for this? What are they like?
Well, there was a variety of instructors. They had, obviously male, female. Myself, as a Latina, I really appreciated just seeing the variety of ethnicities and nationalities on there. Some of them are really ecstatic. they all have their own personalities, and I'm sure that they have followings. I'm sure that there are people who log on specifically for, one person or specifically for another person. But they're just like any other instructors, I suppose. I know that when I interviewed some folks at Mirror, it mostly was just kind of like a word of mouth thing, and folks who were connected to people who helped launch the company. I think they kind of handpicked some of the trainers, and I know that they're expecting to expand their trainers if, you know, once the company starts to expand, but right now there's about 10 or so trainers.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Yesenia Funes. She is a reporter for Gizmodo's subsite, Earther. We'll have a link to her article about the smart ploys of Mirror, how it works and what it does. If you have a question or comment for Yesenia, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You wrote that traditional workout videos lack motivation and instruction you'd get at a class with a real-life trainer. I mean, how does Mirror, do the trainers correct you? Do they see you?
So this was my criticism of the device. So it is equipped with a camera. And so you initially think it comes with a camera, the instructors can see me, which adds not only like a kind of creepy element, you know, it feels 1984-esque, but it also, in theory, could improve your workout abilities. However, the only way for the instructors to see you and therefore be able to correct you is in one-on-one trainings, which as of the time that I had published, and my understanding is this is still the case, had not launched yet. And those one-on-one trainings were also an additional cost. So it doesn't come with a subscription because you buy the device, which is about $1,500, and then you're also paying roughly $40 a month for the classes. And then on top of that, you'd have to pay another $40 per session for this one-on-one training. And that's actually where they could see you and offer some specific guidance. But in the other, in the classes where they can't see you, they're able to see your heart rate monitor data, where they can say, you know, good job, it's really killing it, or they can say, you know, pick up the pace. But that's really the most interaction that you'll get from them, at least on an individual level.
Mm-hmm. And then you always assume they must be talking about the other person.
Yeah, I mean, they you have like their username, so they can refer to you specifically, which is kind of cool. But you know, I thought it would have been nice for them to actually be able to see me if I'm going to have a camera on my home, an extra camera on another device in my home. It would be nice for it to have a use instead of having two weights on that, which is essentially the case right now.
You made the 1984 reference. You wrote that privacy is a concern. How so? Just having that extra camera on?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Mirror was really clear when we spoke that privacy and security was a top concern for them. You know, they even offer a little cover for the camera to help ease any discomfort around that. But, you know, we're living in an age where almost all of our devices have some kind of microphone or have some kind of camera, you know, where that possibility of hyper-surveillance is always there. And, you know, for me, I'm at a point where I don't really need another device that could be hacked by some, you know, brilliant hacker or some evil government agency to keep tabs on me. And so that did make me a little uncomfortable, especially given the fact that the camera wasn't being used. It just sort of was sitting there, potentially capturing anything going on in my living room.
Mm-hmm.
And we are in a day and age where I think this is a valid concern. You know, we see, you know, private companies selling data, selling users' data off, and I think that it's a valid concern for users to have.
In general, you mentioned the $1,500 price tag. There's a monthly fee as well for the classes. There's an additional monthly fee once they launch the one-on-one training later this year. Is it worth it?
You know, I think that if you have the cash, if money's not a problem, yeah, I enjoy having it in my home. I miss it now that I don't have it in my home anymore. I am unwilling to pay that kind of money for fitness. You know, for someone who's paying, who might already be paying hundreds of dollars a month for a luxury gym experience, I can see this being a nice, you know, kind of add-on to that. But I do think that this is a kind of device that's more for, you know, serious fitness gurus who are willing to fork over that kind of cash. I think the everyday middle-class American will not be interested. I know that I certainly am not interested in spending that kind of money on a device.
And have you seen any reviews about how well these kinds of home systems work anyway?
What do you mean?
I mean, if they're better for you, if you get results from them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, that's to be determined, especially I'm not sure if there have been any studies done on the effectiveness of, you know, home workouts. But it's definitely convenient when you're just, you know, waking up early in the morning, don't have time to run to the gym and just need a quick 15-20 minute workout. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the target audience that, the creators had, you know, that, person who's in a rush, just looking for a quick 20-minute workout to get in, you know, in between, you know, maybe before their kids get home from school and before they have to start making dinner. That's really the target audience that, they had with this device. And I think it's really effective in those quick, intense workouts. But I guess it's to be determined if, it works more effectively than, you know, studio classes or actual gym membership.
Is there anything else like it on the market? I mentioned Peloton. Have you tried that?
I have not tried Peloton. No, I would love to try Peloton too. But I think Peloton is probably the most similar in terms of a subscription service accompanied with an actual device. But Mirror is certainly revolutionary in the ability to, you know, see yourself, interact. And, you know, they have dreams of eventually adding other features to the device, whether it's fashion or education, and kind of using it more as a communication tool beyond just fitness. They're seeing it more as like a medium that they can add platforms to. So that'll be exciting if, that actually gets off the ground.
What do you mean by fashion? It's where you could see things on you, that kind of a thing?
Yeah, like, you know, get some kind of a fashion advisor, people giving you fashion tips, you know, perhaps taking classes. They mentioned education. These, of course, are all still very, you know, up in the air ideas that the company has. But this is, they did mention this to me when, we spoke about the product.
Well, Yesenia Funes, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Anne, for having me.
You bet. Yesenia Funes is a reporter for Gizmodo's subsite Earther. We'll have a link to her article about the Mirror. It's a new home gym equipment. It's getting smarter. On our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll have more Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
In WOSU Public Media's newest podcast series, Rivet, young people share their unique pathways to professional success. Listen to This American Graduate Project. Find Rivet now in WOSU's mobile app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Clocks sprang forward an hour this week, as they do every year, in accordance with daylight savings time, an adjustment more aligned with an agrarian society, but embraced nonetheless in 2019. The change is supposed to benefit agricultural workers, but transition also affects the rest of us, often in a bad way. Terry Crowley is a registered nurse, clinical sleep educator, and author of the 2016 book, Sleeping Your Way to the Top, How to Get the Sleep You Need to Succeed. She joins us by phone. Welcome back, Terry Crowley.
Thanks for having me, Anne. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
We just can't get enough conversation about sleep. It's something we all love to do, but and therefore we're always happy in the fall when the hour falls back and we gain an hour of sleep. In the spring, we all start complaining again. So what does an hour mean?
Oh, you know, when it comes to sleep, every bit counts. It really does. And I think the struggle that we have this time of year, every year, pretty much shows us that we're, A, a sleep-deprived society, and B, we probably at some point need to do away with this. I think the research is catching up. You know, there are a lot of health issues and a lot of things, negative things that go along with sleep deprivation, and even an hour makes a difference.
What are the health issues?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, sleep deprivation just across the board really is linked with chronic diseases such as diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, increases your risk of stroke. It's associated with dementia, Alzheimer's. And, you know, we're finding all of this out. And so I think it's causing everyone to take it much more seriously and really be, you know, really hyper aware of, you know, prioritizing sleep, putting it first, and really adopting a healthy sleep lifestyle for the best life possible.
Why is it so hard to adjust to a new sleep schedule?
I know, and it doesn't sound like much, but it is. It throws our rhythms off. We have body clocks that, you know, that so we have our own sort of internal schedule. And even something as minor, seemingly minor, as putting that clock ahead an hour throws us off. And you think about it, you know, we've got more light in the evening. And think about children that need to go to bed early. They really struggle with the change. But even adults, we think the average time lost with sleep is for the time change is about 40 minutes, and it does make a difference. I was traveling over the weekend, and very carefully on Sunday, I went to the gift shop at the airport, got all my items up on the counter, paid for them, and walked away without them. I mean, you know, it kind
of... Well, that's just an everyday thing for me, Terry.
Really,
go on.
You know, sleep, yeah, really, I can relate. It goes beyond sort of feeling sleepy. I think the average person says, well, okay, yeah, I get it. I feel sleepy, but sleep deprivation, more than, you know, affecting our physical health, it affects our psychological health, our cognition, how we, you know, just how we function every day. So it's so fundamental. And you know, we really have not looked at it as a really critical biological necessity. We've just looked at it as sort of a luxury, you know, I'll make time for it if I have the time, rather than saying, no, this is integral to our health and well-being. And we've really got to take it more seriously.
We have an email from Leanne. She says, I have a hard time believing that losing an hour of sleep is really that bad for us because people travel to different time zones all the time and there are no warnings about how dangerous it is and how bad it affects us. If it is truly so bad for us, then why are there no warnings to people who travel? I get completely out when I travel. I mean, it causes me a lot of problems.
I do, too. And the research is showing that there are a lot of issues. You know, I think when people lose some sleep when they go across time zones, they've shown their metabolism changes, their blood pressure increases. I mean, things can happen, you know, sort of on all levels. We tell people to be incredibly careful after an all-night flight. Like, don't drive at your destination the next day. You know, be careful if you have to make critical decisions, business decisions, things like that. So, I mean, I think there are warnings per se, but I think sort of related is, you know, I think more information is coming up about health problems with the time change, but also look at the high school start time issue. I mean, we're trying to get teenagers an extra hour because it makes a huge difference, and there are warnings from very important medical groups out there saying we're really risking their health and well-being. So it's coming out, and I think we're going to see a lot more because I think there's been a bill reintroduced by Rubio trying to do away with these time changes.
Yeah, it's another topic of conversation in Congress. And I think the last time we talked, there was a school district in the Northwest that had changed times for their high school students.
They did, and they've had incredibly good results. And so we really have to look at the science and say it does make a difference, just this little bit, and having that extra sleep time helps with grades. It helps with these teenagers, their outlook on life. You know, depression's an issue. Drowsy driving's a huge issue with these teenagers. And, you know, their short and long-term health is really at stake when we start their, you know, unhealthy school hours when we start too early.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about sleep health today. Terry Crawley is a registered nurse, clinical sleep educator, and author of the book Sleeping Your Way to the Top, How to Get the Sleep You Need to Succeed. If you have a question about sleep health, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's say that I'm going in for my annual checkup Or I'm you know, getting all of my vitals taken like they do at OSU when you're an employee, and then they give you a break on your insurance or something like that. If I've only gotten 3 hours of sleep the night before because I've had insomnia, is that going to change the metrics?
Here's what I would say about that. Treat sleep as a vital sign, because it is. It's so fundamental to our health and well-being. And I urge people, every single healthcare encounter, talk to your provider about your sleep, if you are sleeping, if you're not, if you have insomnia. People tend to sort of ignore sleep problems and think they'll go away. But when we really get back to basics, you know, it affects our metabolism, which would affect our blood work. It affects our ability to maintain a healthy weight. And I see people struggling with obesity and trying to lose weight. And if they're not getting sufficient sleep, it's going to be a really, really challenging uphill battle to do that. So it's just at the core of our health and well-being. So always talk about it and really prioritize it.
Why does it affect our weight? You're saying you just don't exercise as efficiently?
Well, it affects our weight because it affects our metabolism. Our appetite hormones get completely thrown out of whack when we don't get enough sleep. And it also, without sufficient sleep, we don't have the energy to exercise, and we're making very unhealthy food choices because of that. That's how the sleep deprivation affects us. So we really can't, you know, make progress unless we're getting that sleep. And when I talk to people about weight loss, that usually they'll say, oh, Terry, I try to exercise. You know, I'm never motivated. I'm too tired at the end of the day. And then they just can't reach those goals. But I say, look, start with getting a good night's sleep, and the rest will fall into place much easier. And we've also recently found that evening exercise is a good thing, because exercise helps with sleep quality. So don't forego exercise completely if you don't have time in the morning. There's hope for us night owls. We can do a little evening exercise and sleep better.
I got a shot of Kenalog one time in my shoulder to treat some inflammation, and that what they didn't do is talk to me about the possibility that I might be among the 10% of the people that have a really bad reaction of insomnia to the Kenalog. Do you think people talk about the impact of drugs and medications on sleep?
No, they don't. They don't. And again, this is where, you know, it's important to bring up issues. I mean, some people have to, you know, take medications, you know, at certain times of day. I mean, if you have trouble sleeping, that's something. Look at all of the variables, and there are, you know, several. But we have to look at our choices and say, am I going to put this first? Am I going to make this sort of one of the first steps in a healthy lifestyle? And look at medications, look at what you take when you take it, but always keep that discussion open. And I would be caution people that reach for OTC, you know, over-the-counter drugs, to still be careful and talk to your physician about what the best thing is. If you have to reach for those all the time, get at the root of the problem, what's really going on. Some people think it's just insomnia, but they could have an underlying sleep disorder that's easily treated and managed. So it's, you got to get that dialogue and see a sleep specialist for things, you know, for problems that persist.
I was surprised to see in my local pharmacy a whole section now devoted to over-the-counter sleep medications.
Right.
That's
right.
A big deal now.
It's a huge deal. And what I, unfortunately, I think there are a lot of simple things we can do without reaching for those.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of those can have side effects. They can make you drowsy in the morning. They can, the elderly may have a higher risk of falls if they take it too much or too much of it, that kind of thing. But I think, you know, if we get back to basics and just good practice, really good sleep hygiene, and make time for for sleep. I mean, the average person needs between 7 and 9 hours a night. And I think a lot of people are under the misconception that they can acclimate to 5 or 6 hours, they can get used to it and kind of power through it. And that's just not the case. Unless you are a true short sleeper, you're going to go for those 8 hours a night. So you have to kind of start there and then schedule everything around sufficient sleep rather than the other way around.
You know, we've talked before about this, all the screen time we have in our lives these days. And it's hard for a lot of people to draw a line between, you know, using their phone at night and why they're waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning and the relationship between that. What is it? If I'm on my phone right before I go to bed, what difference does it make if I'm waking up at 3 or 4 in the morning? Is that the reason why?
Yes, I mean that blue light messes up the melatonin production. We need that melatonin to be produced to help us fall asleep and stay asleep. And you know, Anna, a big problem. I of course talk about sleep with everyone and anyone, and a lot of people, if they get up in the middle of the night, say to use the restroom, they check their phone.
Uh huh.
So they're right back to square one. That light is affecting their sleep. And then they'll say, well, gosh, I don't get it. I'm up for a few hours. Don't pick up that phone. And a lot of people, I think, to resist that temptation. Well, you know, I just wanted to check one or two email kind of thing. And then the next thing they know, it's an hour.
Well, they're idiots. I can't imagine that somebody thinks that that's not going to, you know, the minute you start checking your email, you're starting to, you fret, you know, you're worrying.
Yeah. And see, but that goes back with, you know, just to some basic education. You definitely would be surprised at, you know, just not connecting the dots. What am I doing that causes this? And then when I have people say, well, Terry, I get up at 2 a.m., 3 a.m., 4 a.m., and I say, mm-hmm. Hey, you shouldn't be watching the clock.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, once you see that clock face, you start doing the math to see how many more hours of sleep you have left, that kind of thing. And it's very, it can be stressful. So by taking these things out, it can be that simple to turn the clock face away. Don't pick up your phone. Don't turn on a bright light if you do get up in the middle of the night. You know, I'm not saying it's common sense necessarily. I don't think we've regarded sleep highly or really, you know, prioritized it enough to think really carefully.
Is that an American cultural issue? Are there other places in the world where they do value sleep?
You know, probably more so than we do. But yes, I do, because I think we've held, you know, in a high regard, we've held sort of that stereotypical, you know, type A business person, forging ahead, ambitious, type A personality. I mean, there's just been sort of an admiration. You know, wow, they can power through it. They, you know, in some sense, I think we've embodied the notion that sleep is a weakness or a sign of, you know, just not motivated, that kind of thing. We really haven't looked at it as that biological need. And, you know, you hear successful people shouldn't make time for sleep, or, you know, don't spend too much time sleeping. But we know that sufficient sleep is the secret to success, not the obstacle to success. So it's really, you know, I think we're flipping the script on how we look at it and how we see how it helps with our health, well-being, and performance.
You talked about some of the things you shouldn't do. Don't turn on bright lights in the middle of the night when you wake up. Don't look at your phone. Avoid looking at the clock. I don't even have one on my bedside table. Of course, my spouse does, so, you know, yay me. Mm-hmm. But what should you do, though, when you can't get to sleep at night? What's a good, healthy protocol? Let's put it this way. Not when you can't get to sleep, but when you wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and you can't get back to sleep.
Well, I mean, I think the first thing is don't panic. I think, you know, my mindset, since I've been in sleep medicine, because we all wake up in the middle of the night sometimes, if your sleep environment is optimized, you have comfortable bedding, you know, a very dark, quiet room, you were probably going to fall right back asleep and not even remember it. If you wake up, though, and then you find yourself wide awake, I mean, first of all, don't try to fall back asleep. I mean, that's just sort of alerting in and of itself. But just relax and just know that you'll fall back asleep. And obviously, you know, if you're on that comfortable surface and you're relaxed about it, you'll likely fall right back. Now, if you have developed something like middle-onset insomnia, again, talk to a sleep specialist. There's cognitive behavioral therapy. I mean, there are things you can do. But I think about things you do when you're awake, during the day that will help you sleep at night, like get exercise, have healthy food choices. That's sort of a bidirectional relationship. Healthy food begets healthy sleep and vice versa. Exercise the same. You know, think of things you do. And then, of course, no late meals, no heavy, spicy meals. And really look at your bedroom and do an audit. You know, just let's say, is it as dark as it can be? Have I, you know, blackout curtains maybe, a sleep mask maybe? Do I need to put on some white noise? I mean, it's t- time well spent to give that some consideration, because that will help with your sleep duration and quality throughout the night.
Why white noise? What is it about white noise that relaxes us?
Well, kind of blocks out some of those intermittent alerting noises, you know, maybe just that some traffic noise, that kind of thing, things mm-hmm. you're not used to hearing. And it can sort of, even if your HVAC comes on and off, things like that, it sort of evens everything out. It's a nice background. There are other things. I do stress that even grown-ups need bedtime routines. We need to have that buffer zone between wake and sleep. And I think too many adults just kind of want to flip the switch, stay up as late as possible, and then hit the hay and say, well, gosh, I'm stressed out because I didn't fall asleep immediately. First of all, I mean, it takes about 15, 20 minutes to fall asleep, but we need that time to relax and transition, and I think it will come more easily.
Nick in Columbus, you're on the air with Terry Colley. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for the topic. I'm in my 60s now, and I've developed a technique, and it does take me about a week to feel good in terms of waking up in the morning and getting enough rest and my bedtime routine. And I just don't change my clocks. That's how I've come to do it.
You don't?
So I know what time it really is for my body.
Huh, okay.
Right.
I started doing that when my daughter was an infant, because, of course, babies don't recognize daylight savings time.
Yeah.
So I just adjusted our schedule to that, up to and including letting her go to school late, or even, you know, calling in late to work, taking an hour of vacation time or whatever, until we were in rhythm again.
Huh.
Right.
What do you think, Terry Crowley?
But it works for me.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I think that's great. Whatever works. And I love the fact that you brought up, you know, the kid thing, because sometimes it's pretty hard on them to try to fall asleep when it, you know, it's light outside and
right.
So that's really important to get that bedroom environment conducive to sleep. It's get it as dark as possible. And there are also things for, say, toddlers and a little bit older called sleep training clocks. And they can, I mean, they're simple. It's sort of, they'll give them a signal, like it's you still need to stay in bed. There's, I think it's a red light and a green light. Like, it'll help them think, oh, the red light, I have to stay in bed. Green light, I can get up. But it's tough on kids.
What about those kind of lights that kind of grow brighter in the morning? Because that's something that I miss once they snag an hour
yeah.
from me, is that I
yes.
hate waking up in the dark.
Oh, and I'm so glad you brought that up. I love those lights, and a lot of people that have used them really like them. And I think it's a very, very good way to wake up. I think it helps start your day off on the right foot. I like that, the whole concept of that light, and because I also tell people, don't keep hitting that snooze button. It's
mm-hmm.
very hard, but I think with that light, they're not inclined to do that, and they wake up easier, and just in feeling better, and that also helps reset their body clock. It's easier, get some light exposure in the morning any way you can, because that helps you actually fall asleep more easily at night.
Terry Crowley, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Anne. Thank you.
That is Terry Crowley. She is a registered nurse, clinical sleep educator, and author of the book Sleeping Your Way to the Top, How to Get the Sleep You Need to Succeed. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Ohio Hospital Association Institute for Health Innovation is expanding education for opioid prescribers at Ohio hospitals this year. This comes as the number of prescription opioids prescribed in Ohio declined for the sixth consecutive year in 2018. Amy Andres is the Senior Vice President for Quality and Data for the Ohio Hospital Association. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
What is different? You're saying you're expanding the education for opioid prescribers. Expanding it in what way?
Well, you know, as we all know, and we've been all paying a lot of attention to the opioid epidemic in our state that's been going on for several years. A lot of the effort has been around dealing with the crisis and trying to reduce the mortality, which had spiked pretty dramatically over the course of a couple of years. And so really what this effort is about is starting to look upstream and, you know, deal with trying to reduce the overall prescriptions, but also help manage long-term chronic pain situations. You know, we have individuals who have been using prescription opioid medications to manage their pain for years. And so looking for ways to help manage that without opioids, or to manage it with a level of opioid prescriptions that is the least amount possible but still effective.
What do the guidelines say to do?
Well, you know, there are broad guidelines and guidelines that the Hospital Association and our members participated in developing over the years. And SmartRx is a program that helps hospitals understand how to comply with those guidelines. And it's a program that has been around for a while. It was a joint effort between the Hospital Association and the State Medical Association to develop a program for prescribers. And what this grant will do is help support continuing that education availability to prescribers throughout the state over the next year. There's also been different types of education opportunities developed under a program that you may be familiar with called Generation RX that was developed by OSU. And that program is really designed for individuals and families to help them understand the risks associated with using prescribed opioids and how to wean yourself off of them and then dispose of them appropriately.
Opioid prescriptions declined in Ohio for the sixth consecutive year in 2018. That's good news. What do you credit that to?
I mean, I think a lot of it, the credit is to education. I think a lot of people really didn't think about the long-term risks associated not only with use of the medications, but with keeping them around in their medicine cabinets, thinking they might need them later, and then they end up in the wrong hands. But, you know, a lot of it has to do with, I think, the nature of managing pain for individuals. It's not a case where, you know, different individuals respond to pain differently. Their pain tolerances are different. Likelihood of becoming addicted can be different. And so, you know, part of this is really about honing our efforts and understanding, based on different types of diagnoses, different types of conditions that patients have, of, you know, where are those ranges of effective management of pain with opioids or with alternative therapies, that can help reduce the reliance on opioids. And that work has been happening for the past several years. And you know, given the degree of the crisis, not only here in Ohio, but now really across the country, there's a lot more effort into looking for ways to more appropriately manage pain, or to manage short-term acute pain or long-term chronic conditions.
The Ohio Hospital Association Institute for Health Innovation is expanding education for opioid prescribers at Ohio hospitals this year. My guest for Wellness Wednesday, Amy Andres. She's Senior Vice President for Quality and Data at the Ohio Hospital Association. If you have a question or comment for Amy Andres, give us a call, 614 614- 292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What about the advent of medical marijuana in the state of Ohio? We've talked a lot about it on this show. It's getting a lot of traction across the country. Is this any part of the hospital a protocol at this point?
It is not. This type of work is really more geared toward opioid-specific type of management of those prescriptions. The type of research and the type of interaction with medical marijuana in this space is not something that the hospital industry or the institute is pursuing at this time.
Why?
I think that right now hospitals are making their own decisions around prescribing and the methods that they feel are most effective. I mean, right now we do have an issue that of compliance with the federal laws compared to state laws. And so, we're early in the process. I think that even, we all see in the news coverage the number of folks that could recommend it's not really even prescribing medical marijuana at this time is a low number. The access to those medications is a very small amount at this time. And right now, to be quite honest, we have enough on our plate in dealing with the opioid epidemic that we have today. And there are other therapies to manage pain, things like acupuncture, things like meditation and massage that are showing a lot of promise in helping abate some of the pain issues and reduce the number of opioids. And so we're really trying to stay focused on the task at hand.
How are prescribers trained to, or what can they do to identify people who are at risk of addiction when it comes to opioids?
Well, the first step is monitoring and initially taking the philosophy of the minimal amount of opioid or other type of pain management that is needed to be effective. And to educate not only the physicians but the families, on the long-term implications of remaining on opioids. And it's this way with any medication, not just an opioid. There are side effects or potentially long-term consequences that need to be considered when you actually take a medication, often for a very appropriate purpose. That's part of it. And some folks, some of your listeners may not be aware of a statewide program called the ORS program that is really set up to help physicians see and understand the level of prescribing that is happening for patients when it comes to opioids and identify where there may be the case of a prescribing abuse situation. And so all of our physicians and prescribers across the state actually refer to the ORS program to identify those particular situations.
Do the challenges differ when it comes to the type and size of the hospital?
I don't think so. We took a look at when, we started this work a few years ago and looked at, not just on the front end, the prescribing, but the effects of the opioid epidemic and individuals overdosing and ending up in the EDs. We found that just 25 emergency departments were bearing 50% of the weight of the overdoses. And so we thought, I think a lot of people think, oh, this is more of a rural thing. Well, that actually is not the case, and it's more concentrated in the metropolitan areas. But even when we look at, what level of the EDs are being hit compared to the overall emergency department visits that they have, and that number only expands to 38 hospitals. So, you know, we've pulled those folks together, and some of them are rural hospitals, many of them are metropolitan hospitals, to get an understanding of, you know, what they're dealing with and what the differences are. And we're really finding that it's a pretty cohesive cohort of hospitals that are dealing with a lot of the same types of issues.
Is it getting easier to track when a patient or a person is going to different providers to get opioids?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that definitely is something that is easier to track. And part of that, part of that is, you know, hospitals don't necessarily all have access to every prescription that is written, especially if the patient goes to an individual provider that's in a different network or that sort of thing. But the insurance providers do have access to that information, and the OARS system does as well. So for folks that may not be using their insurance for their opioids, the OARS system would really catch where you have volumes of prescriptions that are really starting to exceed an appropriate level.
Do we know if there are any pill mills, as we know, as we refer to them, left in Ohio? It was a big deal down in southern Ohio, but they were all over the place, too.
Yeah, there were. And, you know, certainly the crackdown on the pill mills and the effort between, oh, I'd say 2011, you know, through recent times. I mean, there was a lot of energy and effort put into shutting down those pill mills. And, you know, obviously that was very important. But one thing that was equally as important and the thing that we're really focused on today is getting treatment to individuals who are addicted. You know, although that effort focused on eliminating supply, of course, was very important, but if you are now addicted to opioids and you don't have any treatment options, that puts folks in a very difficult situation and really led to, you know, the heroin epidemic that we dealt with after, you know, shutting down the pill mills. And so, you know, right now, the real call to everyone is to focus on helping get folks access to appropriate treatment to manage the condition. I mean, this is a long-term chronic condition for somebody who, once they are addicted, it's not a quick fix situation. And the other thing is prevention in these activities around, you know, obviously not adding to the numbers of individuals that are unfortunately now addicted to opioids.
If someone comes into a hospital, they say they think it's a kidney stone, they're in a lot of pain. That's a classic complaint that you can get some Dilaudid or something like that. And, you know, that's something that hospitals look for. I know they resist giving people anything for a while to make sure that they're not addicts seeking drugs. But what's the protocol if somebody comes in complaining of pain in a hospital like that? How does it work?
Well, I mean, you know, there are prescribing guidelines to really help inform how those prescriptions and what level of prescribing is appropriate in an ED. And a lot of the continuing education that we talked about around SmartRx helps, you know, with providers see where those lines are and those morphine equivalents. But, you know, it really comes down to an awareness throughout the state that has built with all providers over the last several years as we've been trying to deal with this very large issue that took decades to culminate into where we are today.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's fair to say that the emergency departments, there is a very clear understanding of those guidelines, and they want to make sure that patients are taken care of, but they also want to make sure that there's not an abuse situation, so they're going to refer to OARS, the OARS system.
Mm-hmm.
We have a statewide health information exchange that can help with managing the long-term care of the patient. As well. And, you know, I think that the other big cultural shift, not just in Ohio, everywhere, mm-hmm. is as a healthcare system, there was a lot of attention put on how providers were evaluated or rated on their ability to manage pain.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so much so that there are financial penalties if providers did not manage the pain of a patient in a way that the patient deemed satisfactory. And so, you know, we've ended up with a situation of couple of decades of that. And then realized, we may have gone to, this is all culminated in a very bad situation.
I'm sorry, Amy Andre, Senior Vice President for Quality and Data at the Ohio Hospital Association. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.